Okay, so welcome everybody. Welcome to our Saturday morning on this first ever parents retreat at Adistana. So how we've planned the morning is that I'm going to do a little bit of a talk, and then we'll have a tea break. And there'll be time for sort of some discussion and questions after that, and then we'll have a tea break, and then we'll go to the shrine room, and Papadira is going to lead a meditation workshop, which will seamlessly flow on because we're all very well joined up, which is good. So hopefully you're all sitting comfortably. How I've termed this, what I've called this talk, is six gifts of parenting. You'll find out when I get to them, they're not denying some of the inherent challenges that are integral to some of those gifts. But I also wanted to start by, saying who I am and where I'm at. So I've been practicing in the context of Tri Ratna for more than half my life.
Right.
I think last year it tipped over, which was nice. And the way I feel is that practice, that Buddhist practice, is alive, it's energized. I feel motivated, orientated towards unfolding, towards awakening, and not just because I fancy ending suffering for myself, which just definitely has it as its attractions, but also just as the most helpful possible way to be in the world. Also to say, is that traditionally communicating the Dharma is the greatest gift that any of us can give. Some of you will have known from study it comes up in one of those lists of the six gifts. And I really believe that, that it's the most helpful thing that I can contribute. And particularly in the context of parenting, which I see as a very fruitful context for Buddhist spiritual practice and meaningful and effective practice. So one of the things I want to do with this life is do anything I can to help sort of combat a sense that parenting isn't a helpful context, or it's the challenges outweigh the benefits, for example, and to enable you, because you're the ones that are here, but parents in general, to feel inspired, energized, confident, able to practice in however that manifests or doesn't in terms of formal meditation practice on the cushion, but just in general, in terms of a meaningful spiritual practice. And it was interesting listening last night to people introduce themselves, and some people saying specifically about wanting to slightly narrow that gap between at home as a parent and spiritual path, particular or the ordination process, and wanting to sort of narrow that gap a bit. And when I was sort of reflecting on after that, I realised that actually my taking steps of commitment within Tri Ratna and my parenting are intimately linked. I've been around since 1990, but originally, in quite a light touch way, and because I wanted to meditate. But asking to be a mitra was after my second child was born, Ella, my daughter, I remember being at Taraloka and just feeling so grateful that I had that context, that I had access to it, that I could go on retreat. And that was like, okay, this is really important, and then I must have become a mitra. And in a very sort of similar way, at Taraloka, I realised I wanted to ask to be ordained, a few years later, I think it was 2001, and that was after going through divorce and sort of messy times, and again just being so grateful for that context that it sort of enabled me to sort of stay sane and vaguely focused on a bigger picture during that time. And then something else that someone mentioned last night was around mitra study, and actually I think stopping it, somebody was talking about. And study's never really been my way in, but obviously I did do mitra study and I appreciated it, but always when I was doing it, I was applying everything to my context, so what does that mean? What does that mean for me? And I've been a working parent all through, but I was applying it mostly to the parenting context rather than the work context. So every mitra study project I ever did was so what does this mean for me as a parent? And it was that that gave rise to writing a book, but I had a copy with me, I was going to wave it about. I know some of you here have read it, and that was, it was really a culmination of that. It was a culmination of sort of applying everything to that. And also what people mentioned last night was finding it challenging to feel criticised or excluded as a parent, you know, for whatever reason within Triratna, which I think is, you know, is something that we can maybe unpick a bit more in the groups if that works. And I think it's important. I mean, I think I've been relatively lucky. I think it partly depends on where you are geographically and who you know and when you were around. You know, I had small children in the 1990s, and I was in the North London Buddhist Centre, which was just quite a sort of open, accepting environment. And my experience all along has been that when you push at a door, it opens. Obviously, that relies on having the energy and time to push. You know, and you've found the same. It's not necessarily easy, but it's, you know, stuff can happen. You know, so you know, the book, you know, write a book, okay. You know, and I approached Windhorse, and they'd been trying to find someone to write exactly that book for 4 years and bit my hand off. You know, it's, can we start a parents, a family group at North London? Yes, you know, do you want a cupboard for toys? Yes, it's fine, you know, blah, 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 you know, all of that. And, I mean, in fact, we've been doing mother's retreats, weekend retreats at Taraloka. This will be the fifth year. And that wasn't my idea. But this one, again, I contacted Adisana last year. What about one for parents, you know, because, and they was like, yeah, great, you know, programme is about to be finalised, couple of dates. That's partly why this date clashes for this weekend, because it all just happened as they were finalising the programme. But again, you know, just really sort of pleased to be doing it. So along the way, because I've been doing all of that for a very long time, and I've been practicing in this context for 28 years, and 24 of them as a parent. So in that time, I've given a number of talks. I listened back to the ones on Free Buddhist Audio just so I didn't repeat myself too much, in case any of you have listened to them. Mm-hmm. And but it's always really helpful to sort of focus from a new perspective, and I've been enjoying doing that in terms of preparing for this one. So when I was reflecting on this, I framed it as six gifts of parenting that felt current. And they overlap with the ones that the chapters in the book that I wrote, but they're not identical. So in a moment I'm going to list them, and then most of this talk will be unpacking those six gifts. But just in terms of my context, so as I was saying last night, I have two children, not really children anymore. One of them is 6'4", works out, he's like that. They're both taller than me. But I think one of the things in terms of context is I have a daughter who's 21 and has just finished a maths degree at Manchester University. And, you know, seems to have always had easy friendships. She's got a nice boyfriend, competent, entrepreneurial. Seems to be that she'll be fine. Anything could happen, but that seems the way. And I also have, my son is 24, and I, you know, I term it as still finding out his way in the world. You know, with both of them, I'm very connected with both of them. We have good relationships with both of them, and certainly with my son, we have sort of really interesting, deep conversations about religion, the world, politics with a small p, you know, lots of different things. He's very engaged and independent minded, though, with some quite black and white ways of seeing things that trip him up in the world. So that's my sort of parent, you know, that's the context. But also the other thing I wanted to say by way of context is that I think what is important is view. So the view of being, you know, so primarily a Buddhist on a spiritual path, and parenting is part of the context in which that happens. So that's the sort of view from where I'm coming from. So, for example, last night Lilipa was saying, you know, that being a Buddhist has made him a better parent, being a parent has made him a better Buddhist, so both those things are true. That my sort of main sort of focus is on the, I don't remember which way it was, but the being a Buddhist and parenting is supporting that as context. I think I take it as read that being a practicing Buddhist will support my parenting, but that's not, that I'm focusing more on the other aspect of it. But I think that's really important just in terms of that sort of view and how we frame things, because it changes how you see everything, that crops up day by day, minute by minute. You know, actually, I'm a Buddhist, I'm a practicing Buddhist, I'm on this path. And, this is what's on the path, basically. Hopefully that will become clear. So these are the six that I've picked out. I've actually wrote them up on a flip chart, whether you can read that or not, I don't know. But they're sort of, so one of them is about, I'll list them anyway. There's not being in control, being more playful, open, flexible and observant. Third one, access to a wide range of emotions. The fourth one is humility, but that definitely with sort of kindly acceptance and looking briefly at remorse rather than guilt. Love and letting go, and access to insight. So those are the six things that I'm going to unpack. But also what I would encourage you to do when I'm talking about them, so I'm just going to give little examples within each of those, but it might be helpful for you just to have a think of the stuff that arises for you where, well, yeah, I remember that gift in my experience, you know, because you will have all had examples and things. So it'd be quite interesting just to, it might be good to hear some of them at the end of my talk as well, you know, just examples that you've got within any of these six, because as I said, they should be quite familiar, I think. So the first of those gifts, not being in control. So this is probably the greatest gift. I think Vantig is quoted as saying something along the lines of, you know, life is king. You know, we have this illusion that we are in control of it all. And actually, when I was thinking about that, sometimes as a parent of young children, it actually does feel like, you know, you have an almost magical power. That sort of, I remember fondly those days of being able to kiss it better, you know, to graze me, kiss it better, they run off, they're happy in it. So then maybe it does feel like, oh yes, I could do this, you know, I could make it all better. But, you know, whether it's like babies that won't sleep when we need them to, or, you know, like my daughter's classmates in her teen years not being that kind or inclusive, or, you know, my son resolutely confusing to conform and mostly refusing to go to school. You know, there's always moments where that magic power isn't available, often to a really, really, very, very big extent. So, you know, we've all heard talk probably about actually when you're on a spiritual path, our enemies are our biggest spiritual friends. You know, they're the ones where there's that sort of grit in the oyster, the thing that makes everything change. And in my experience, my children can really meet that well, which obviously links to humility, which I'm coming on to. But, you know, some of the most powerful opportunities for practice have been in this context of not being able to, you know, it just being so evident that I can't control reality, I can't control the way things are. I mean, Jai, my son, is probably the best source of that material, and sort of loads of it through the school years, you know, that sort of endless mornings of getting in, you know, the immense amount of will to get him out of bed, out of the house, and with the right books on his back. And then getting a call from school, Jai's not in school today, but he went. But, you know, the memory that came back when I was thinking about it for this talk was the when he was allegedly doing an access to university course after, I think he had sort of three attempts to start A-levels. I mean, he got pretty good GCSEs without really going to school, but you can't do that same sort of minimalist autodidactic approach beyond GCSE, I think he found. But that what was interesting about that year when he was sort of allegedly in college was that I was also quite specifically engaged with it as an inquiry into the nature of craving and aversion, of wanting things to be other than they are. So, you know, as well as actually just living it, you know, I was actually using it as quite a specific inquiry. And, you know, so what I wanted in terms of reality was for him to be enjoying it, turning up, making friends, doing what he needed to get to university. You know, behind that was because I wanted him to leave home as an independent adult. But, you know, and my well-being, you know, particularly in the mornings, on those mornings where I knew he had classes, my well-being was pretty bound into whether I heard signs of him getting up in his bedroom or not, and at what point that was happening. And there was either a sense of real tightness because he wasn't, or there was a sense of release because, oh God, he's moving, that's good, you know. And it was extraordinary. And also about how he talked about college on the days that he did make it. You know, and I remember endlessly walking past his closed bedroom door with this sort of, you know, and sometimes smelling all sorts of things you shouldn't be smelling. and then, you know, with this sort of sinking dread of, oh, what am I going to do about Jai? You know, it was so, you know, but, you know, and there were times where that felt really unbearable. And I would sit with this sort of overwhelming sense of, you know, I suppose the unsatisfactoriness of life, which is pain, isn't it? The extent, you know, to that extent of really wanting to scream. And then there were other times where I could watch those feelings, or the same times even, I could watch those feelings sort of just ebb and flow. And I could experience up close, directly, the reality that what I wanted to be reality was as much a conditioning factor as whether he was getting up or not, or whether he was late or not. And I could see that, you know, you could actually sort of see directly that momentum that of just, it's like beating my head against a wall. And at times where that, I could see that in a much more wide open space of how, you know, just naturally as human beings, we want a different reality than the one that's there. And that's what brings suffering. So it's basically the second noble truth. You know, if most people here are familiar with the four noble truths, you know, there is unsatisfactoriness and there's a cause of it. So it's just like being like that with the cause of suffering. Well, unsatisfactoriness, I think, is a better word, really. The second noble truth. And also, in a way, you know, at the best moments, being able to see the utter ridiculousness of that. You know, why do it to ourselves? Why am I standing here, beating my head against this wall, wanting things to be other than they are? And also being able to see, really, at those moments, how that wasn't helpful for my relationship with him, or being able to see him clearly. The whole feeling of it's like tight, fixed, rather than receptive, open, connected, loving. And so it's like, as I say, this sort of gift of parenting, of just being able to watch that loop happening over and over again, to experience directly the sort of getting stuck in that, the tightness, the pain, the lack of connection, and also the what it happens when that releases, you know, simply being with things as they are, and, you know, sort of preferably with a degree of compassion and acceptance and, at best, humour as well. So that's the first gift. I don't know if that one resonates for anyone. I know you may have examples coming up in your mind. There's a few nods. and then the second one, I'd thought I'd do it on a more, you know, well, I don't know if positive, negative, I mean, it's all just stuff, isn't it? But I think the other thing, when I enjoyed looking back at, you know, all those years of being a parent and a Buddhist, you know, and one of the things is that they've been really good at sort of loosening up a fixed view of me, who I am, what I like, what I don't like, what I do and what I don't. And for many, many years, they were great playmates, you know, they were really, really fun. You know, and even, in fact, last month, I remember I went go-karting with my son for his birthday and loved it, you know. I was way, way slowest. I was the only person that was waving other people past me. But it was really fun. It was great fun, and I was quite fast, and I was fast on the second lot. Anyway, competitive age. Anyway, but also, you know, just thinking back over the years, you know, we camped a lot. We spent hours making intricate road systems in sand on beaches and pointlessly carrying water from the sea to a hole in the sand where it disappeared, you know. And there was a phrase that I think was on a recent area order day in London. They were doing it, the mandala of greater uselessness. So I mean, what greater uselessness is there really than carrying seawater to a hole in the sand? You know, and then later, you know, when they were in their teen years, we spent, for many years, our family went diving together, which was a real privilege, and it was wonderful to be able to do. We learnt to dive together, and then went, you know, and it's sort of images of just sinking deeply into blue sea. And it's like, I remember at one point it really being a wonderful metaphor for shunyata, for emptiness, because it's like, you're sinking into these depths and there's just blue. It was where there was an extraordinary visibility, so it just, there's blue forever. You know, like you have the blue sky analogies with emptiness and shunyata, but actually you can't really inhabit the sky because you fall out of it. In the sea you can, you know, especially if you're, you know, because you're weighted and, you know, because of the buoyancy, you can just sink really, really slowly. But also, you know, the thing with shunyata is that it's not empty, it's full. You know, it's just empty of what we assume is there, but actually there's a real fullness and life in the whole ungraspability and emptiness of shunyata. And the same with the sea, you know, there's all these organism and microscopic things happening. It's alive, it's really live. Yes, yeah, so that was extraordinary. You know, and obviously it's a challenge, you know, to find holidays that work for people, and obviously financially as well. I mean, it was a sort of a priority for me for years in terms of holidays. And retrospectively, I'm really glad that we did that. But obviously I was also lucky in that sense. But I also spent many, many hours with salt dough and paints and on the floor making stuff out of Lego. And I, you know, it's very interesting. I liked reflecting back on it and thinking, I don't think I can regret any of those hours. You know, it's like, and you know, I remember also one example of spending an enormous amount of time looking into a big hole on a building site en route to the beach. And we did it every day on this week's holiday. And you know, it's, and just that sense of, I'm orientated to the beach because that's nice and it's going to be more fun, but the kids just want to look into this big building site hole, and actually just being able to eventually relax into just being with them in the building site hole. You know, and also just the, you know, like walking to the shops. You know, I remember at one point going to the shops with a two-year-old and walk, you know, it wasn't very far, and walking very slowly and somebody overtaking me and saying, oh, you don't get anywhere like that, you know, very slow. Just like, well, I'm actually not going anywhere. We just are, you know, we're just walking down this road and, you know, at some point we might get to the shop and whatever. But those are the, you know, and but yet so much of the time, with, I mean, those are, I'm picking out the moments where I was aware because those are the ones I can remember. But so much of the time I was just in forward momentum with a list, stuff to tick off a list, stuff I needed to, you know, wanting to get through that moment to get to something more important. And that is my sort of natural way of being, that sort of forward momentum, you know. I mean, it's a bit less now, but people who know me well know it's still there. you know, but you know, the moments I look back on, obviously, and where I have that sort of heart singing moment, like the big hole, at times when I was just, you know, with the colour or the paint or the Play-Doh or, you know, with the children. You know, so overall, when I look back, I feel like I was definitely there for their childhoods. You know, even though, I mean, I was also working and I had that forward momentum and I was often in a list mode and I wanted to, I was present often enough. And I think that's, you know, I've never had that sense of, whoa, what happened? I blinked and their childhood disappeared. And even though I suspect that the percentage of time I was that fully present, like with the Play-Doh or the Lego or the sand or whatever it was, are actually relatively quite small as a percentage of time, I think because they are so powerful and being present is so powerful that they do make, it makes a real difference. And I think I probably did it enough. And I'm very grateful for having a practice, you know, that I was already a practicing Buddhist when I had children. And obviously any moment in time is an opportunity to do that, to sort of notice the forward momentum, notice that it means that you're not connected, breathe, feel your feet, you know, tune into the heart area, be aware that this moment too shall pass, you know, really sort of make the most of that moment with children. And also just being that, being able to open us to new experiences and slow us to toddling pace, which is, you know, really a different way to look at the world, isn't it, with beginner's mind, with freshness. You know, and also just to play. It's nice to play. I've missed them as playmates, really, because they're not, they're sort of mostly gone, really, now. Yeah, so that's the second gift of parenting. And the third one is access to a really wide range of emotions, which I think you can really see resonates. And, you know, what I was thinking of when I was thinking of this was four, you know, four things really, sort of a sort of depth of passion of love that made me imagine sort of tearing another human being limb from limb if they were to threaten this tiny creature. Near murderous rage at something this slightly less tiny creature was doing or refusing to do. Swelling pride and joy at their successes. You know, my children, well, Ellen particulars. Stop, you're not crying, are you? And, but also anxiety, dread, hopelessness in the face of their challenges and not being able to kiss it better. So those are just a few. But from a Buddhist perspective, it is really helpful to be open to a wide range of experience, that whole gamut of what it is to be human, and not to be chopping things off at the edges because they're unacceptable or they don't fit with our image of what it is to be a good Buddhist, what it is to be a good parent. And obviously, we don't want to just let rip and behave however we want based on those strong emotions. But actually feeling them, feelings need to be felt, and being able to open to that and feel that is really essential. And as we unfold on a Buddhist spiritual path, in a way it's sort of inevitable. You sort of can't do it without, because you can't really relax and allow things to unfold if there's stuff that is not, was refusing to be felt or refusing to be seen. So the fact that it is there much more up close and personal is really helpful. And especially when, you know, like everything, where it's important that the lens we're looking through is, you know, I'm a human being on a Buddhist spiritual path, and that's from that perspective, it's really helpful. Because also that depersonalizes and allows some space around stuff, you know, when you can actually look at things and think, wow, it's extraordinary, I'm getting so worked up about that, or wow, that's such an intense feeling, you know, you can actually experience it without being lost in it. Yeah, and I came up with a sub benefit, a sort of 3.2 on this one, which was also that I think being parents, having children, calls us to be our best selves a lot of the time. And some of the examples I was thinking about were, for example, the need to exemplify fearlessness. You know, I think one of the things that was very present for me was wanting my children to be confident, to be fearless, not to be fearful of the world. You know, and that meant I needed to jump off some rather large cliffs, literally rather than metaphorically. you know, just to do quite a lot of things that exemplified that. And also, I mean, we were talking, my Trinita and I were talking on the train about that sort of period where I was separating from my husband. And my Trinita was asking, did my practice help? And it was so essential, you know, to actually have a bigger picture, to have a way of sitting with things, to be able to orientate, but, you know, in a sort of try not to do any worse harm sort of way, and really being able to stay grounded and within that whole time. You know, but there's loads of other examples, you know, not swearing. I stopped swearing pretty much when my children learned to talk. doesn't sound that pretty when they're three. Unfortunately, I think I've started again a bit now. They do it anyway. But then, you know, or how we respond to people, you know, in, I don't know, restaurants or wherever it is. So that was my 3.2. So the fourth gift was. I'm still sitting comfortably. The fourth gift was around humility, but with kindly acceptance. And this was mainly that, I mean, I think from my perspective, if I just inhabited the world of work, I would probably kid myself that I was pretty calm, controlled, in control, able. And and I think a lot of people in the world of work would see me that way. So it's been really, really helpful to have access to knowing that that is not the full picture, that that is not the reality, that there's an awful lot else happening. And also, I think one, I mean, obviously there's loads of aspects with all this, and hopefully things are coming up, occurring for you as well. But I had a thought a few years ago, because really from the time my son was 13, for probably 10 years, there was that sort of beat my head against a brick wall aspect of it. But a few years ago, I had this thought that arose, which is, you know, who would I be without Jai, in a way? You know, it's, I could be, possibly totally unbearable. And probably, I would have less empathy and less ability to connect with a really wide range of other people's experiences. You know, there may be an aspect where I'd be listening to somebody talking about, oh, my son, this and this, and I'd be thinking, how can that happen? You know, but actually, I know. Obviously, it happens in different ways for different people, but it's, that is just, so that's a really big aspect of it. You know, and I think also within this, I mean, I'm always really clear to make the distinction that I wrote a book about how to be a Buddhist in the context of parenting, not how to be a good parent. And to me, that's a really helpful distinction, because I think I have managed to be a Buddhist in the context of parenting, and I feel really confident about that and clear about communicating it. But I didn't do parenting right. I just did my best in any given moment with the skills and resources available to me at that time. And I am absolutely certain that is what we all do, you know. And I did, you know, would shout. I stopped shouting when it became absolutely evident that it really, really wasn't very helpful, because they could shout back louder and it made it all worse, and I had to apologise and things like that. But that's, you know, it's not that I did it well. But one of the things I did do was follow the only advice my mother ever gave me about parenting, which was just keep them talking, darling. Just keep them talking. And then they'll talk to you when they're teenagers. And that was true. They did. Though recently, you know, when they were sort of later teens or early 20s, there's been times of conversations happening in the kitchen, and I'm like, you're not supposed to tell me that. And they're like, but you said we could tell you anything. Not that. So one of the aspects of this, obviously, is kindness towards ourselves, because I think as a parent, guilt can be so prevalent and so undermining, and it's so easy to blame ourselves for how our children are, you know, and that's the same whether they're 2 or 22. But ultimately, from a sort of Buddhist perspective, a perspective of insight from a Buddhist perspective, The narratives we have about ourselves and whether we did it right or wrong and where we did it right and wrong are just that. They are just narratives. They're a conceptual overlay. They're a story. They're something that we overlay on experience to make sense of it, to make sense of the experience. It's not wrong that we do that. It just happens. It's an aspect of being human. But ultimately, those narratives, those stories, those, the way we've made sense of things, are insubstantial. They're ungraspable. They're not real, solid, true. And yet, they can also be very powerful. they can have a really powerful effect. So, you know, I blamed myself for years, you know, like with my son, yeah, well, I got divorced, I was overcompensating, trying to be both parents. I mean, his father was very involved as well, but, you know, at the times when I was on my own, I was too lenient, I wasn't strict enough. And obviously we can reflect, we can learn, and that's important, where we can improve how we're doing things, you know, and that, you know, so that is helpful, where we can change things. But the past is somewhere where we can't change things. It's past, it's over, it's gone. And so at some point, a few years ago, it occurred to me that an alternative narrative for me with my son, which had ultimately the same insubstantial nature but was much easier and more positive to live with, was that Jai was never going to conform to school. It was just the wrong context for him, and I could, you know, homeschooling wasn't something I was open to, and probably wouldn't have worked. And that actually perhaps the way I was with him as a child, in sort of pre-teen years, enabled him to get to 13 before any issues really manifested. And so the way I was with him enabled him to have a really solid basis of being loved and accepted, you know, in those early formative childhood years. And as we know from all sorts of developmental stuff with children, that's a really massive protective factor to then being able to confront difficulties later on. So who knows what's true? There isn't a true, there isn't a false. But that one is a much more helpful narrative for me to live with. And it's one that enables me to engage better with him, apologise for where I've got caught up in being very punitive without seeing him or whatever, what was actually going on, and where listening would have been more, making more sense. So it's quite interesting sometimes to look at the stories, the narratives we have around these things, and just see, well, maybe a different one would be more helpful here. And it's no less true or no more true. So, love and letting go. Let me do the other two a bit more briefly. So, I mean, obviously this is just a really massive area, isn't it? Because actually being a parent gives us access to, usually at some point, an immense tapping into the power of love in human beings, of unconditional love. And yet, from really, really early on in our children's lives, we have to keep taking steps back and letting go and letting be and letting them be who they are. You know, for me at the moment, those ones are like, my daughter has our car at the moment at Manchester. And her driving, that's a really good example. I don't feel safe with her driving, but she, you know, she passed a test at 17. Driving is an important adult life skill. I have to let her do it, even facilitate it. So it's just, so I have to sit with it. I'm thinking, oh, but she's driving from here to here. She hasn't yet phoned me to say she's arrived. You know, that it's all, you know, that's just stuff. That's the practice, isn't it? To be able to inhabit that space of totally loving and yet allowing that, not being able to hold, not being able to wrap in cotton wool and keep safe in those ways. You know, it's just, and that's true, you know, for quite young children, but to different extents. But also just letting go of our images of how we want them to be or how we want us to be. I think I'll skip that anyway. Yes. I mean, overall, I think I found it relatively easy to step back at the different stages of their lives and to celebrate them sort of going forth. And I think partly that's because I have been, you know, Buddhist all the way through this. So actually being a parent is only part of the identity that I have. This is far too absolute, but I always used to frame it as, you know, 20 years of hands-on parenting, 20 years of whatever's next. And in fact, that was another bit that I didn't say at the beginning about how my commitment with Intri Ratna and the parenting have gone fairly hand in hand, because actually, as they came up to sort of leaving home age, I became a preceptor. So that's yet another sort of stepping in and commitment in terms of, you know, ordaining other people. But yeah, the loving and letting go, there was another thing I just wrote there actually, which was about, I also thought that was an important thing to try and pass on. And one of the ways we did that when they were children was that we spent years fostering kittens. We had stray cats coming, they'd come pregnant, have the kittens, and then when the kittens were old enough to be homed, it was through a charity, they homed the mother and the kittens. So there was lots of having to, you know, adoring these tiny fluffy things and then saying goodbye to them. Anyway, who knows what difference that made, but I remember liking it. It was probably just an excuse, I'm not kidding. Yeah, so just finally and quite briefly, because it's in a way it's a sort of culmination of all the other bits I've said, is that also I think the context of being parents when we're on a spiritual path is also a fantastic context in terms of access to insight. And in lots of different ways, you know, partly change. Children change more obviously than adults do. You can watch it happen. You know, needing to hold quite lightly to all sorts of things like expectations of how it's all going to go. Being able to see our own conditioning and what we bring to parenting and how we experience our children, how we experience everything. You know, you'll probably see strands of what your parents said in terms of what you're doing or avoiding doing. You can see all of that sort of flow of conditionality. But also that thing about really being brought up close and personal against ourselves. You know, as I was saying, experiencing the Four Noble Truths close at hand. And also the sort of just being stopped in our tracks, slowed down, made more aware. You know, there's invitations, particularly through the eyes of smaller children, to mindfulness, to take a fresh look at the world. And also just looking through the lens of all we know of the Dharma. You know, I know that most of you've done quite a lot probably of reading and study. You know, including from an insight perspective, you know, insubstantiality, emptiness, ungraspability, shunyata. You know, and in a way, what better teachers around all of that than our children? You know, we can hold them in certain ways, and when they're small, we can hold them very tightly. You know, at times, but not ultimately, we can't. You know, and so that obviously points to, you know, what we know from Dharma, that access to that insight is available in the context of being parents by looking directly at that, you know, and experiencing it close up. And that's not saying, I also want to acknowledge that can be very hard, especially when we are in a sort of functional mind all the time, ticking stuff off lists, having to get stuff done, da 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 da. That makes it much harder. But, you know, we don't need really to be anywhere else, and we don't need to wait for them to grow and leave home. You know, and actually if we didn't have children, that would have a different set of challenges in our lives, and there'd be other things that would be getting in the way and other things that we'd be worrying about. So although it's not necessarily easy, the access to insight is really about just stopping and looking and being where we actually are, and all of those things in terms of the conditions, the change, the insubstantiality, the ingraspability of it all. It's not easy, you know, we're wired. I mean, one of the things that came up quite strongly when I was on a solitary retreat a couple of years ago was this phrase, you know, we're wired for survival, not happiness. And, you know, that everything in the way that we're conditioned as human beings comes from the need to survive and to check out what's safe, what isn't, what's going to help me, what's not. It's like somebody used the phrase recently of your inner meerkat. You know, it's like, oh, is it all right? Was it? And that's, you know, that very much, you know, with children as well, it's like, oh, was that a mum? Was that all right? You know, is everything all right? It's like this... hypervigilance, you know, and just, you know, obviously there's a need for vigilance at times, but it can become a habitual way of being. We're totally always on, you know, and hypervigilant. And you know, one of the issues with that is we get stuck in it, you know, we get stuck in it and it becomes a habitual way of being. So another sort of real encouragement with this, in terms of also just the access to insight element, is being able to learn to let go when we can, to really relax and relax a bit more deeply. You know, so relaxing, looking through that lens of Buddhism at our direct experience, everything is just there, everything we need is there moment by moment. So a lot of it, yeah, just taking the opportunities that there are to be relaxed. You know, a lot of us are a lot less relaxed than we could be, you know, even including when meditating sometimes. So relax, have a look. And that confidence, really, that we've got everything we need. We all know enough Dharma. We're in a good context. And so I'm going to stop there, but also to be aware that, you know, our practice as Buddhists can mean loads of different things, and Upayavira is going to sort of pick that up and take us further with it after the break. You know, and that doesn't have to be, you know, like this morning we had a double sit in a lovely shrine room. It doesn't have to be that. I mean, on one of the mother's retreats, one of the things that we were emphasising is, you know, perhaps your practice is 5 mindful breaths. And if that's your practice, or it's 5 mindful breaths 5 times a day, if that's your practice, then doing your practice, that's what's important. You know. So it's whatever is possible, whatever can be integrated. But this thing of just constantly reorientating and looking through the lens of Buddhist spiritual path, and that everything in our lives is just the context in which we're practicing, it can all be brought onto that path with us. Okay, stop right there.